Okay, so we're at the top of the hour. Hello, everyone. My name is Chris Ribbons, and I am with TEDx, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange. I would like to welcome you to today's call, which is titled Perinatal Outcomes and Unconventional Natural Gas Development in Southwest Pennsylvania. Our moderator today will be Kim Schultz, TEDx's research assistant, who heads up our oil and gas program. Our speaker has provided slides to accompany her presentation, and the link to download them was emailed to everyone who registered for the call. If you still need to download the slides, you can do so now from our website at tedx.org. On the homepage, click on the link in the What's New box on the right-hand side, which says Teleconference Series on Oil and Gas. This will take you to the call page. Once on the call page, you can click on the link to download the slides. This call is scheduled for 30 minutes, with time at the end of the call for questions. Due to the high number of participants on the call, if you have a question or comment, we ask that you post these to our live chat. You can access the live chat by going to the call page and clicking on the link provided. We will be monitoring all of the comments and questions throughout the call, and we'll read questions to the speaker after her presentation. Right now, everyone has been muted with the exception of our moderator and our speaker. As I noted, the call will last 30 minutes, and it is being recorded. With that, I'm going to hand things over to you, Kim.
Thank you, Chris. I'd like to welcome everyone to the second teleconference call in our series. We are so pleased to be able to provide the service that directly connects scientists with people from academia, government, healthcare, and the general public. I'm happy to introduce Dr. Shana Stacey. Dr. Stacey is a postdoctoral research associate at Brown University School of Public Health. She received her Master's of Public Health and PhD in Environmental and Occupational Health from the University of Pittsburgh. During this time, she investigated the effects of environmental exposures on infant and children health. This included her work exploring the potential health effects of unconventional natural gas development in southwest Pennsylvania. She currently is exploring the impact of endocrine-disrupting chemicals, such as bisphenol A and triclosan, on children's neurobehavioral health. And now I'll turn it over to you, Dr. Stacey.
Okay. Thank you for the nice introduction, Kim. And I would also like to thank the Endocrine Disruption Exchange for having me speak today. Like Kim mentioned, I am currently doing my postdoc at Brown University. I'm working with Dr. Joseph Braun, investigating exposures to bisphenol A and effects on children's neurobehavioral health. But as you know today, I'm here to talk about some of the work I did as part of my dissertation when I was a graduate student at the University of Pittsburgh, studying the potential effects of unconventional natural gas development on infant health. So with that, let's get started. If you move on to slide 2, this is just a brief outline of my presentation. Since our time together today is relatively short, I'm not going to go into too much detail about the background of unconventional natural gas development. I know that many of you are already aware of the basics, and we had a nice introduction last month during Chris's talk. However, I will give some background about the motivation for our work and also some background on unconventional natural gas extraction in Pennsylvania, where we did our birth outcome study. And then, of course, I'll go into some more details regarding our approach, and I'll highlight some major results as well as some future directions where I think this work is headed. So if you advance to slide 3, the motivation for our birth outcome study. We know that unconventional gas development, which I've abbreviated UGD in this presentation, has the potential to increase both air and water pollution and any associated health effects. We know that air pollution can result from emissions during the actual drilling of the well and also increase truck traffic to and from drilling sites, just to give a few examples. And we're also concerned about water pollution as well. So we know that during the hydraulic fracturing process, they're pumping large amounts of water mixed with sand and other chemicals into the ground. We might be concerned about migration of this hydraulic fracturing fluid to underground groundwater drinking water resources, And we might also be concerned about potential contamination of drinking water during the storage and disposal of the wastewater that comes back up. The produced water not only has the chemicals used in the hydraulic fracturing process that are used to break up the shale around the well, but it also brings back with it naturally occurring contaminants from the earth. So we might be concerned about spills and leaks related to disposal and storage of the produced water. To date, a few studies have sought to link UGD with human health effects, although there is a growing body of research that's starting to do this, including the handful of UGD and birth outcome studies that have come out during the last 2 years. Infant health was of particular interest to our group because we know that, first of all, infants are a vulnerable population. There are windows of vulnerability during gestation and even early childhood when infants and children may be particularly susceptible to the effects of chemical exposures. And as I have on this slide, this also translates to health across the lifespan, that exposures during these time periods can affect not only the health of the infant, but also the development of chronic disease later in life. Further, several of the pollutants emitted during UGD activities have been associated in previous studies with poor infant health outcomes. For example, exposure to benzene and diesel exhaust has been associated with increased risk for low birth weight and preterm birth, just to give a few examples. And also, as we heard last week, some of the chemicals involved in the hydraulic fracturing process has been implicated as possible endocrine disruptors. Moving on to slide 4. These are two maps showing the growth of UGD in Pennsylvania. On the left, you can see the growth of these activities in the entire state. These are wells that were drilled between 2007 and 2012, and you can see that most of the activity is happening in the southwestern portion of the state, up through central Pennsylvania, and then, of course, through northeastern PA. On the right, you can see our three-county study area. So these are three relatively rural counties, Butler, Washington, and Westmoreland, that surround Allegheny County, where Pittsburgh is. So this was our three-county area. We focused on 4 years, 2007 to 2010. And you can see the little black dots are the active unconventional natural gas wells in these three counties during this time period, just to give you a little bit idea of the growth of UGD during our time frame. If you go to slide 5, the objective of our study was, of course, to assess the impact of UGD on infant health in southwestern Pennsylvania. And as you'll see, to do this, we used well density as a surrogate for exposure, which is something we do when we have a lack of environmental sampling data. At this time, we're not really sure what exactly people are being exposed to, so this is a first step to get an idea of if these activities are something we should be concerned about as they relate to human health. And knowing what we do about some of the pollutants that are emitted during these processes, we hypothesized that the risk for adverse birth outcomes would be greater for infants born to mothers living in the most densely drilled areas. On slide 6, you will find a little bit about the approach that we used. So our study sample included 15,451 singleton live births, as I said, in three counties in Pennsylvania from 2010 to 2012, or sorry, 2007 to 2010. This was birth certificate data that was obtained through the Pennsylvania Department of Health. And it was a data set that included a geographic location, so a latitude and longitude for where each mother lived at the time that the baby was born, as well as information on the birth outcomes we were interested in. And also, as you'll see, it was a very rich data set with regard to other maternal risk factors that might be related to our outcomes of interest. We obtained natural gas well data from a publicly available data set, the oil and gas reports, provided by the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. This is something that anybody can access from their website. It's a data set that includes, again, geographic coordinates for all wells, information on when drilling commenced, which is something called the spud date, unconventional or conventional designation, which has to do, of course, with the use of the hydraulic fracturing process, and finally, whether the well was designated active, abandoned, etc. Just to give you an idea of some of the information you can find out from these oil and gas reports. Since we had a latitude and longitude for each mother's residence and each unconventional well, we were able to bring this data into a geographic information system software, so I used ArcMap, and we were able to calculate a distance between each mother's residence and all of the active unconventional natural gas wells within a 10-mile radius of her residence during the birth year. If you move on to slide 7, you can see the metric that we used. This was a method that was used by McKenzie and colleagues to study UGD, also in relation to adverse birth outcomes in Colorado a few years ago. Using their method, we also calculated an inverse distance weighted well count, which you'll see is abbreviated IDW well count in the rest of the presentation. We calculated this for each mother living within 10 miles of unconventional gas development. And just as another note, inverse distance weighting is a technique that is often used to estimate the combined effects of multiple point sources of air pollution, again, when we don't have a lot of environmental sampling data. So as you can see, it's a fairly straightforward formula. You're taking the inverse of the distance between the mother and the well. You're doing this for every well within a 10-mile radius of her residence, and then you're summing them. Really, the takeaway from this is that this formula is giving greater weight to the wells that are closest to you and giving less weight to wells that are further away. Next, if you go to slide 8, after we calculated this IDW well count to represent exposure for each mother in our study sample, we categorized the mothers into quartiles of exposure. So we compared the second, third, and fourth quartiles, which from now on I will refer to as the low, medium, and high exposure group, to the first quartile, which is our comparison or reference group. That reference group had IDW well counts less than about 0.9, and our most exposed group of mothers in the fourth quartile had IDW well counts between about 6 and 114. On slide 9, you can see our outcomes of interest. We analyzed birth weight as a continuous variable. We also looked at small for gestational age as another metric to see if children were unusually small for their gestational age. So if you don't know, SGA is defined as having a birth weight within the 10th percentile for your gestational age and sex. And finally, we also looked at preterm birth, which is defined as having an age of gestation less than 37 weeks. In our models, we wanted to account for other risk factors that might affect birth weight and preterm birth. You can see them here. I won't go through all of them since, you know, we're short on time today. You can ask any questions at the end if you would like. Just to give some examples, we adjusted for race, education, whether or not the mother smoked during pregnancy, as well as whether or not she received this women, infants, and children assistance, which was our variable indicating socioeconomic status. But I think we should move on to slide 11, which is the beginning of our results section. Table 1 is showing the breakdown of the maternal and child demographics for the total study sample, as well as broken down by those quartiles of exposure I referred to earlier. You can see that there were some small differences in some of these variables across exposure groups. And even though they were small differences, they did happen to reach statistical significance, likely because we had a relatively large sample of 15,451 women. To go through a few examples, the fourth quartile, which is made up of our mothers most exposed to UGD, there was a slightly higher percentage of African American mothers in this group, as well as slightly higher percentages of mothers who received WIC and who smoked during pregnancy. In the last three rows of Table 1, you can see the breakdown of mean birth weight and percentages of SGA and preterm birth across our exposure groups. Again, there are some small differences, and you can see, for example, for small for gestational age, that proportions of SGA tended to increase as exposure increased. And this is, of course, before we're adjusting for any other risk factors. Moving on to Table 2 on Slide 12, this is the result of the adjusted linear regression of birth weight in our well density variables. So this is accounting for all of those covariates that you saw in Table 1, mother's age, education, etc. And if you look again at the last three rows, these are the results for our low, medium, and high exposure groups compared to the referent group. And you can see that in the fourth quartile compared to the first, that there was a decrease in birth weights with increasing exposure to UGD, and this was a statistically significant result. Moving on to slide 13, figure 1 is showing the unadjusted and adjusted logistic regression results for small for gestational age, and you can see that both before and after we included all of those other maternal risk factors, we see sort of a suggestive dose response across our exposure quartiles. And you can see that this does reach statistical significance, again, for that most exposed group compared to the referent. So this is indicating a possible increased odds for small for gestational age with increasing exposure to UGD. Finally, on slide 14, figure 2 is showing the results for preterm birth. Again, before and after adjustment, these odds ratios were a little bit more all over the place. We don't see a nice pattern like we do for small for gestational age. And actually, in the second quartile compared to the first quartile, we see a decreased odds for preterm birth with increasing exposure to UGD. However, this is a relationship that doesn't seem to hold up for the third and fourth quartiles, which have even more exposure. Moving on to slide 15, just to wrap things up and to recap, we found decreasing birth weights and increased risk for SGA associated with increased well density, particularly for the most exposed mothers in our group. And again, like I just showed you, for preterm birth, we saw a decreased risk for preterm birth in the second quartile compared to the first. We did do a few sensitivity analyses and saw that our associations with birth weight and SGA remained when we used continuous IDW well count as our predictor of interest, as opposed to comparing quartiles of exposure as I presented today. And they also remained when we limited the analysis to the year 2010, which was the year in our study period with the most UGD activity. So this is obviously indicating that our analysis with all 4 years is perhaps being primarily driven by that last year with the most intense activity. On slide 16, I have a few future directions where I think this field is headed. Obviously, when we do a study like this, it's preliminary. We're hoping that it motivates further research where we can get better individualized exposure assessments and also environmental sampling to find out what these mothers are actually being exposed to and what contaminant or groups of contaminants might be behind the associations that we're seeing. As far as what the group at the University of Pittsburgh is doing, I unfortunately don't have any preliminary data to share today, but we do have blood samples from about 150 pregnant women who underwent routine prenatal testing. Again, these are mothers from southwestern Pennsylvania. And we are analyzing these blood samples for metals. I have a few examples listed here, arsenic, cadmium, mercury, and lead, as well as a few other things. And again, we're hoping to look at these concentrations in relation to where these mothers are living, how close they're living to UGD, how that's associated with concentrations of these biomarkers, and also later extending this to associations with adverse birth outcomes. So that's all I had for today. I wanted to briefly acknowledge the Heinz Endowments who funded this research, and also I would like to thank my dissertation advisors when I was at Pitt, Drs. Bruce Pitt and Evelyn Talbot, as well as our other excellent co-authors, Drs. Luann Brink, Jacob Larkin, Joel Sadowski, and Bernard Goldstein. And again, I wanted to thank Chris and Kim for their introduction and the Endocrine Disruption Exchange for inviting me to speak today. And now I can answer any questions that you might have.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Stacy, for your presentation. And I really look forward to hearing more about the what's going to go on with the personal exposure in the future. And also it would be interesting to see as the intensity of drilling has raised so much in southwestern Pennsylvania, I'd love to hear more about maybe that future. Mm-hmm. But I have some questions for you. So these are from our chat page. As a reminder, from our website at tedx.org, you can access the teleconference page in the upper right. And midway down that page, you'll see a link to ask a question via live chat. So I will start with the first question here. Wish I could turn that off. Would this methodology work when there is a high density of mothers to drilling sites as opposed to a high density of drilling sites to mothers? In Los Angeles, urban drilling is a major issue. While there may not be several sites within a neighborhood, there's an extremely high density, 22,000 per square mile, of people living near a single drilling site.
That's an interesting question, and I think it's definitely an important one, considering that, you know, when we have more highly populated areas that are being exposed, you know, we definitely want to make sure we can investigate this so we can find out what's going on and protect people's health. I think probably the biggest challenge to looking at something like this in a more urban area is that you are going to have confounding sources of air pollution. So just to give a quick example, you know, in Pittsburgh and Allegheny County, we actually don't have a lot of drilling going on, and of course we would have a lot of confounding sources of air pollution. Traffic is more concentrated in urban areas. We specifically would be worried about, you know, emissions from fossil fuel burning, power plants, things like that. So I think you definitely could look at it, but that might pose, that part of it, confounding sources of air pollution and other pollution might make that a challenge to look at.
Okay, there's a question that's kind of builds on that. It's asking directly what parts of the unconventional gas extraction process or pollutants emitted from these processes do you think might be the culprits behind the associations you observed?
Right, and right now all we can do about that is really, you know, speculate. Of course, the next steps, like I said, would really be taking air and water samples in these areas, which I know some groups have started to do. As far as air pollution goes, like I said, you know, diesel exhaust from the diesel-powered drill rigs has been implicated in other studies of increased risk for low birth weight. also exposure to benzene. And as far as water pollution goes, if the water used during the hydraulic fracturing process that contains the chemicals to fracture the shale around the well, or any of the naturally occurring contaminants that are coming back with it in the wastewater, if that is reaching drinking water sources, that could also be a problem. As far as naturally occurring contaminants go, they have found increased concentrations of certain metals in fracking wastewater. That's been, for example, processed at wastewater treatment plants, which we don't do anymore in Pennsylvania, but we used to, and they have found elevated levels of certain metals. And some of these metals have, in other studies, been found to increase risk for things like low birth weight and small for gestational age. So those are a few possibilities, but like I said, what we really need to do is start figuring out what people are actually exposed to.
Okay, great. The EDC is commonly in UGD, like 2BE and ethoxylated nonphenols, I believe, are VOCs. VOCs are generally challenging to capture air samples, although they can persist in the environment for a long time. Do you have any recommendations for how to do environmental sampling for EDCs?
Oh, for EDCs specifically? Well, I know that for if we're talking about certain types of VOCs and other air pollutants, you know, we could talk about things like setting up stationary air monitors near homes. Also, there are passive air samplers that people can wear. You know, depending on what you would want to look at would depend on what kind of sampler you would want to use. But those would be ways that we could capture some of the VOCs and air contaminants to determine what people are being exposed to. So that would be my recommendation as far as air pollution goes and some of the EDCs that might be associated with these activities.
Is post-term birth considered an adverse health outcome? Do you look at complications of birth or induced labors?
That is, you know, something we could look at. We did not look at complications of birth or induced labor in our study. But I think those would be, you know, possible health outcomes we could look at in future studies. So, yeah, any sort of post-term birth complications might be interesting to look at. Keeping in mind, you know, and I'm honestly not sure about as far as birth complications go, but, you know, thinking about the pollutants that are emitted during these processes and if there's a possible biological mechanism that could lead to some of the birth complications we might be interested in.
Well, kind of building maybe in that, there's a question. EDCs are also suspected of causing infertility. Do you know of any studies that may have looked at proximity to UGD or conventional and its impact on fertility? Is it too sensitive a topic to investigate?
You know, I don't know of any studies to date that have looked at that, although I think that would definitely be something important to study. Many of the adverse birth outcomes and reproductive outcome papers that have come out of this have focused on, so for example, Casey et al. Recently looked at using a data set from central Pennsylvania, the more central part of the state, also looked at things like birth weight and preterm birth. The McKenzie article that I mentioned, in addition to looking at birth weight and preterm births, they also looked at some congenital anomalies and other birth defects, but I'm not aware of any papers that have looked at infertility yet.
I have a couple more questions, if you don't mind running over just a few minutes.
Oh, no, that's fine.
Okay, thanks. So let's see. How about very interesting results? It looks like the results indicate more of an effect on growth retardation than prematurity. The sample is both preterm and term births. Do you think it would find a stronger effect if you looked at birth weight decrements among term births only?
That would definitely have been a sensitivity analysis that we could have done, a stronger effect. That's definitely a possibility. That's not a sensitivity analysis we could have done. I do think that it's nice that, since small for gestational age is sort of a little bit of a better way maybe to get an idea if there's an effect on if a baby's smaller than he or she is supposed to be, it is nice that our SGA results agree with what we saw looking at birth weight as a continuous variable. And I will also note that although we decided to present SGA in the paper, it was also an agreement when we looked at low birth weight dichotomously. So babies weighing less than, I think, 3,600 grams compared to babies weighing more than that for low birth weight.
Okay, and here's one last question that can kind of sum things up. How does this study advance previous studies on the relationship between gastroing and adverse birth outcomes?
Oh, sure. Well, so the first study, obviously, that came out about this was in 2014. It was the McKenzie study that they did in rural areas of Colorado. And, out in the West, in states like Colorado, they've been, UGD has been happening for a few years longer than it has in Pennsylvania. So our study was the first study to apply the inverse distance weighting methodology to try to look at this in southwestern Pennsylvania, which no one had really done when we started our study. And I think that together what's coming out of these studies is suggesting that there is perhaps something going on with UGD in relation to adverse birth outcomes that is worth looking at in future studies.
Okay, well, thanks so much for answering the questions, and thanks everyone for attending today. We hope you'll sign up for the final call in our series with Dr. Nicole Desiat. She'll be presenting June 2nd on the reproductive and developmental toxicity of chemicals in hydraulic fracturing fluids and wastewater. And now back to Chris to close the call.
Thank you, Kim. I want to make sure that everyone knows that there will be an MP3 recording of this call available on our website soon. We encourage you to share it with others. I would also like to remind you again of the next call in our series that will be on Thursday, June 2nd at 2 p.m. Eastern, and will feature Dr. Nicole Desiel, who will discuss a systematic evaluation of chemicals in hydraulic fracturing fluids and wastewater for reproductive and developmental toxicity. Please mark your calendars and register for the call from our website soon. We will send out an email announcing when registration is open. Again, I would like to thank Dr. Stacy for taking the time to present her research, Kim, our moderator, and thank you to all of the participants for taking the time out of your day to join us. I hope that you all have a wonderful rest of your day.